You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about an award that celebrates young farmers in Wisconsin and the nation and talk to this year's recipients about their experiences. First, have you noticed that apartment buildings that have gone up over the last few years all seem to have a very similar look? A kind of bland, boxy, people say, colored panels, flat windows. They're like this, apparently, all over the country. Some Twitter users have come up with names to describe the architectural style: SimCityism, Blandmarks, and McUrbanism, just to name a few. So what's going on? Rick Moeller is an associate professor of architecture at the University of Washington. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Well, have you seen this around the country? Is this not just a local thing? It's really happening all over the place?
Apparently not. It's very common and is a topic of much conversation in Seattle. I know it is in Portland to our south, and I've read about it in a number of fast-growing cities all around the country.
And I've seen similar styles in some places in Wisconsin, too. Is there a name for this style? Is there a way that architects are describing this?
It's really a simple, modern box. It mostly has to do with the building type and the way it's constructed. Most of them are light wood frame apartment buildings, usually on top of a commercial base. Here in Seattle, we tend to refer to them as 3-over-1 or 5-over-1, meaning either three stories or five stories of wood frame construction on top of a concrete base that usually has commercial uses below. The construction lends itself to a much boxier look, generally speaking. They tend to be clad in a material called hardy panel, which is a cementitious board or panel. It's actually a very good product. It's very durable, relatively inexpensive, both in terms of material and installation. Takes paint really well. So it has a lot of things going for it, but it tends to be used on almost all of the buildings that are being constructed. Another aspect of these buildings that contributes to the look is they tend to have what is called nail-on-flange windows. These are windows that are attached directly to the surface of the framing, and as a result, you really don't get any depth on the facade the way you would in, say, an older brick apartment building.
Now, is this an aesthetic trend where we have designers all over the country stumbling into the same concept, or is this something that's driven by economics mainly?
It's driven largely by both. I would say about 20 years ago, and I count myself among them, architects really, quote unquote, discovered this material. It had been used by builders for years. Architects, I think, were at first enamored by the simple, smooth surface that one could get from this material. I would say since then, architects have generally been less enthusiastic about it because it is being used so extensively. But you touched on the other big issue, which is really cost. In Seattle and in just about every fast-growing city around the country, we're experiencing a housing affordability crisis. And so being able to build mixed-use multifamily buildings for a lower cost is a huge benefit. And I think all of us, regardless of our attitude about these buildings, we need to consider the balance between the cost of building much-needed housing and the aesthetic results of that. I will say, I can speak for Seattle anyway, one aspect of these buildings that has generally been relatively successful is the ground floor. They tend to have a lot of transparency, a lot of openness to the commercial spaces that are on that ground floor. They tend to have awnings that extend out over the street. And I think that from a design standpoint, because we have design review here in Seattle, that tends to be a major focus. And I think generally that's pretty successful. I would also argue that that's probably the most significant aspect of the building, is the way it really relates to the street, the way it really relates to pedestrians who are walking past the building. Seen from a distance, I would agree that they tend to be less successful.
Talking to Rick Moeller, Associate Professor of Architecture at the University of Washington, about these apartment buildings. You can see them, especially in cities, growing cities in Wisconsin and around the United States. A lot of them look the same. We're talking about what's driving that. And Rick, some of the online reaction that's been out there has not been kindly to these buildings. Are there really legitimate aesthetic or even structural gripes about this? Or is this just kind of like a little bit of snobbishness about a style that's caught on?
Well, I'm an architect, so I need to be careful about accusing anyone of being a design snob. But I would there are a couple of things that I think really need to be taken into consideration. One is, and this is true in Seattle, and I think it's true in a lot of cities, we have reserved a lot of our land in Seattle. About three-quarters of all the land that is zoned for residential use is zoned detached single-family. A very small amount, about one-quarter of that amount of land, is zoned for mixed-use multifamily buildings. So I think part of the reaction is not just the buildings themselves, it's how many of them are being built, how quickly they're being built, and they're all being built in the same place. So I think part of it is really just this kind of shock of the new. The other thing that needs to be taken into consideration, for example, I had mentioned our single family. We have a lot of craftsman-style homes in Seattle. The vast majority of them were built between 1900 and, say, the mid-20s. When that was taking place, there was a tremendous amount of criticism of this development, partly because it was all happening so fast, it was all happening in the same place, and they all tended to look the same. Now, 100 years later, we look at that consistency and we see it as a positive aspect of these buildings and a positive aspect of these neighborhoods. However, things that are being built now that all look the same are seen as a problem. Now, I am not arguing that these buildings 100 years from now will be upheld as fantastic examples of architecture. However, I do believe that over time, they will settle in, they will be seen as just more part of the built fabric, and they won't be seen as these shockingly new things.
You mentioned zoning, and that's a big part of the story here. And you mentioned that in many communities, there's this favoritism, I guess, in zoning toward single-family housing. Have we moved too far in that direction? Is that part of a problem that you see?
Yeah, in my opinion, that is a problem for a number of reasons. One is that I already mentioned it's forcing, certainly in Seattle. It's forcing almost all of the growth of the city into 15% of the city's land area, so that 50% of the city's land area be reserved for detached single-family houses. But there's a larger equity question at work here, which is that single-family neighborhoods also tend to have the best access to schools. They tend to have the best access to parks. They tend to have the best access to other publicly funded amenities. And the problem with this is, in a lot of these cities, the cost of owning a single-family house is getting to be so high that very few households can afford to do it. So by reserving all of this land for single-family dwellings, what we're actually doing is saying only a very small percentage of the population that can afford to purchase a house in these neighborhoods will have access to things like parks and schools and other amenities. Before we had single-family zoning, and we're now going back to the 1920s and 1930s, there was a mix of housing types. There were duplexes. There were triplexes. There were small-scale courtyard housing. There were even small-scale apartment buildings in a lot of these neighborhoods. We now call it the missing middle of housing between larger-scale apartment buildings and detached single-family dwellings. So in a lot of cities around the country, a conversation is emerging, which is, why don't we make these neighborhoods more flexible so that we can have a greater variety of housing types within them, address the housing affordability crisis, and at the same time, make these neighborhoods more accessible to a broader range of incomes.
We'll leave it there. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. My pleasure.
That's Rick Moeller, Associate Professor of Architecture at the University of Washington. We talked with him about why so many new apartment buildings across the country look the same these days. Coming up, we'll talk to the winners of the 2019 Wisconsin Young Farmer Award. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the latest on a possible government shutdown, part two, and last-minute negotiations to keep the government funded. That's part of our weekly review of national politics. First, think about everything that today's farmer has to do. They have to know all aspects of farming, be an entrepreneur in the sometimes complex world of agribusiness, and understand what animals, crops, and consumers need while protecting natural resources. Those are just some of the qualifications detailed by the Outstanding Young Farmer Program. It started in 1954, and it honors farmers for those achievements and more. Adam and Chrissy Seibel own and operate Seibel's Organic Dairy in Bloomer. They won the title for Wisconsin's Outstanding Young Farmers in the most recent go-round. They join us now. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Chrissy, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, Adam, let's start out with you. What was your experience with agriculture growing up?
I grew up on our family farm. It was just a small 45 to 50 cow barn. We milked about 45 to 50 cows. Only had 120 to 150 acres, and I would help out, you know, between sports and throughout school whenever I had a chance.
And Chrissy, what was your experience with agriculture growing up?
I didn't grow up on a farm myself, but my dad did, and so my grandparents lived on a farm, so I definitely was exposed to agriculture growing up.
And Adam, tell us about your farm operation. What all are you doing there?
So we are a certified organic dairy farm. We milk 120 cows with two DeLaval robotic milkers. We have approximately 1,200 acres that we cash crop and then also feed to our cattle. All of that as well is certified organic. And then we also direct market meat to consumers right off the farm here, and then we also sell to local grocery stores and restaurants.
And I understand, Adam, you were one of the first organic farms in the country to have these robotic milkers. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. They were on conventional dairies for, you know, probably 4 or 5 years before that. But yeah, we were one of the first in the area to put them in.
And now, Chrissy, you two have won the Outstanding Young Farmers Award, and I understand part of what you do on the farm is help introduce more young people to agriculture. You recruit youth, I think, interns or people to work on the farm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I teach high school science here in our area, and so we work a lot with bringing in high school students to, or even we have a few technical school students that come in and do chores and learn about what it looks like to work on a farm and take care of animals. And so I help find those students and work with them through their internship program.
And Adam, a story we've heard a lot here is about people not wanting to stay on their family farm, younger people moving out of town, moving into different lines of work. What is it that kept you interested in agriculture?
I just enjoyed working outside. So this was, you know, one thing that I was obviously working outside a lot. But the other thing is with agriculture, it's you're never, or working on a dairy farm, you're never really doing the same thing multiple days in a row. You're always doing something different. So you're not just constantly repetitively doing one thing. And I like the variation that comes throughout the day.
And what led you, Adam, into organic in particular?
That was a decision that my dad had made before I came onto the farm. Just something that I guess at that time he was really looking for a more stable milk price, a little bit, you know, better milk price. And he was pretty close to being organic anyway. We just had to change a few little things. And he thought that that would financially be a better move.
We're talking to Adam and Chrissy Seibel with Seibel's Organic Dairy in Bloomer. They won the latest year go-round of Wisconsin's Outstanding Young Farmers Award. Chrissy, what did it mean to you? What was it like to win this award as Outstanding Young Farmers in the state?
It was a pretty amazing weekend. We got to meet the other seven finalists, And we were pretty shocked when we won. The other finalists were really amazing. It was a really diverse group, and it was just really fun to meet them and hear their stories and see what they were doing on their farms. And so, yeah, winning, I think any one of those other couples could have won just as easily.
And Adam, I think when people think about farming, they think about the actual, you know, tasks of raising crops, milking cows, that sort of thing. Can you talk about being an entrepreneur and a business person as a small farmer?
I guess that is a little bit more difficult being smaller. You don't have as much diversity as, or you don't have enough or a large enough group of animals to really, I guess, for lack of better terms, to make a mistake on. So you really have to watch every little nook and cranny when it comes to the financial side of things with that.
And Chrissy, can you talk a little bit about your view on the business side of farming and the different things you've branched out into?
Yeah, it's interesting with just being, you know, it's Adam's family, so it's his mom and dad on the farm, and then his brother is also on the farm. And so it's really just us doing every single aspect of the business, which is, I think, pretty unique in terms of, you know, all the different careers that are out there. We take care of all of our own finances. We do all of our own paperwork. We do all of our own hiring. So Adam is the human resources person and the accountant. And, you know, I mean, there's some things, obviously, like taxes and things that we have support on, but it's definitely a challenge. And there's a learning curve, learning to take care of all of those things yourself.
Adam, you mentioned the prices of organic milk. We hear a lot about very low prices for conventional milk being an issue for farmers, especially smaller scale farmers. Are you seeing some of that even with organic?
Yeah, in the last couple of years, we've seen just about probably about a 40% reduction in our pay price. So on the organic side, we've really felt that crunch as well. So it's not just affected on the conventional side.
And you mentioned the direct-to-consumer meat marketing that you do. How important a part of your business is that?
It's not a huge thing. We just like connecting with the community. It gives people in our area a source of grass-fed organic meat. It's not something that we do a lot of. We do enough of, but there's just only so much time in a day that we don't go out of our way to try to sell every animal that way. We just do a small number of it that way.
And Chrissy, Adam mentioned the community. Having joined this farming family, do you feel like part of a community of farmers and people who buy their products in your region?
Yeah, we have a pretty strong community, and we try to be a part of our local community and invite groups out to our farm and let school groups and local community organizations come out and see where their food comes from and take part in different activities that we have going on the farm.
Adam, we've talked to people who run programs trying to bring young farmers into the profession, especially as older farmers retire, trying to come up with succession plans. What advice would you have, Adam, for people who are getting into farming maybe for the first time now?
I guess just don't be afraid to try a new path. That's one thing that really worked well for us was just to kind of think outside the box and, you know, don't be afraid to be the first person to try something. Just because it hasn't been done before doesn't mean that it can't.
And Chrissy, as a teacher, do you see farming, agriculture being on the radar for the students you teach?
Absolutely. There are students who are very engaged, and it's always fun to be able to have those students then come out to the farm or become employees, or some of them just come out to visit. But there are students that definitely are in that agriculture, agri-science field.
And Adam, I know a lot of Wisconsin farmers have won the award you won and then went on to win the National Outstanding Farmers Award, I think 18, something like that, over the years. Do you have high hopes for winning at the national level now?
I guess I'm just happy to go and compete and meet the other contestants that are there. I guess as far as winning, that's sure, that would be a great honor, but that's not something I'm just going to set myself out to make sure that I try to do that. This is just what I do, and I just tell people my story, and if people feel that this is, or that I deserve to be the national winner, then so be it.
And Christy, do you know the timeline for when you'll know if you win the national version of the award?
So next February, so a whole year from now, we will go to Connecticut to compete.
And Adam, we've heard people talk a lot over the years about how consumers of food aren't really connected. We don't necessarily know where our food's coming from. We don't know what life is like as a farmer. What would you say about your life in farming to people who were, you know, distant from it, who just consume the products and that's it?
Well, definitely not an easy one. It's something that, you know, 7 days a week, and then on our farm it's 24 hours a day that cows are being milked and work's being done to produce food. And there's numerous other farms out there that are that way as well, where it's a 24-hour a day job. And no matter the weather, no matter what the conditions are, animals need to get fed and chores need to be done. But it's not an easy lifestyle.
We'll leave it there. Adam, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Christy, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Been talking to Adam and Christy Seibel. They own and operate Seibel's Organic Dairy in Bloomer. They won the title for Wisconsin's Outstanding Young Farmers for 2019. They're in the running, and good luck to them for the national version of that award. We'll find that out about a year from now. They joined us to share their experiences in farming. Coming up after the news, a deal to fund border security and avoid government shutdown part two is moving toward a vote in Congress. We'll find out how likely it is to pass and then get President Trump's signature. That's part of our weekly roundup of the news in national politics. You can weigh in on what looks like a deal to avert that shutdown. Should Congress pass it? Should the president sign it? Should the president use emergency powers to try to find funding for border structures that aren't funded by this deal? Let us know. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. After 8 years of no pardons in Wisconsin, Governor Evers says he's going to grant them. Coming up, we'll find out how pardons work and what they mean for the criminal justice system here in the state. First, we take a look at some of the week's top stories in national politics. A freshman Democratic representative is facing criticism for a tweet about an pro-Israeli lobbying group. The Senate Majority Leader is planning a vote on the progressive Green New Deal. And reports say President Trump is likely to sign an agreement on border security that would avoid another government shutdown. Our question for you this week, do you think President Trump should sign this bill if it's passed by Congress, which includes $1.3 billion for barriers on the border? Should he seek money from other sources? Do you think Democrats are giving up too much money for a wall? Should we be thinking about border security in terms of a wall in the first place or using the money for other security measures? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for The Guardian. Lauren, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to start with something you've been writing about, actually. Representative Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, has been criticized for tweets she made regarding a pro-Israeli lobbying group. She later apologized for the remarks. Still a back and forth going on. Can you tell us what happened here?
So from the beginning, on Sunday night, she tweeted something that was, you know, widely condemned as an anti-Semitic trope. It sort of played into this idea of Jews and money, and was, you know, widely condemned, as we said, by her own party. Nancy Pelosi led a leadership condemnation of this. So Ilhan Omar, she came out and she apologized. She said unequivocally she did not mean to, you know, degrade, to insult anyone. Her point, actually, she wanted to make a point about the corrupting influence of money in politics. So here we are a few days into it, and the controversy is still ongoing because now both the president and the vice president have weighed in and called on her to Trump has said she should resign from Congress, but at the very least she should be stripped of her positions on the committees in Congress. Now, there is a parallel going on here. Republicans recently stripped Congressman Steve King of Iowa of all of his committee appointments because of comments he made related to white nationalism. So Republicans are trying to draw a parallel and saying what she did is the same. She should be taken off, especially the Foreign Relations Committee, where she now has a seat as a freshman Democrat. So this is the stage we're at right now. Now a lot of several progressive members are kind of circling around Omar saying, look, the president has no standing to criticize someone for being anti-Semitic. He himself didn't condemn neo-Nazis during a rally in Charlottesville in 2017. So there's really now what started is Omar being sort of very much in the wrong. They're now sort of back. There was sort of bipartisan condemnation of Omar, and now we're seeing, at least now we're seeing Democrats sort of defend her and say, look, she apologized. She's trying to make this right. Mr. President, when have you apologized? When you've, made these sort of racial transgressions or not stood up for the Jewish people, et cetera. So that's where we are today. We know that Steny Hoyer, the majority leader, he's a Democrat from Maryland. He has said she will not lose her position for committee assignments despite the calls to do that. But he said he's going to watch her very closely. And if in the future, her rhetoric doesn't change, if this becomes a pattern, then he will hold her more accountable or, take action at that time.
On a wider note, is this a running theme, younger freshmen, first-year Democrats, maybe more progressive than the average Democrat in Congress, having tension with the older, maybe more moderate leadership? Is this a thing we're seeing a lot of these days?
Absolutely. You're seeing there's still very much a minority, but a vocal minority of these incoming class of liberal progressives who want to challenge the status quo on Israel. They think, look, if the government in Israel is extremely conservative, we want to be a more pro-Palestinian voice in Congress. And one of the very rare policies where both Democrats and Republicans seem to still agree and very, very strongly agree is on sort of the U.S.'s posture towards Israel, its strong support for the nation. So this is very much out of tune with the rest of Congress, with their party, but also just Congress writ large. So they are facing a lot of backlash, and there's a lot of progressives, among them Jewish progressives, who say, we are with them, we take their point, we want to have this debate, but they need to be careful about the language that they use in doing this, because now, you want to very clearly distinguish between a debate on policy and a debate about the government versus, something that falls into, that is problematic and uses anti-Semitic rhetoric, et cetera.
Talking to political correspondent Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's turn to this ongoing story, an attempt to avert a shutdown, a second shutdown. What is the latest, Lauren, on a deal?
Fingers crossed. It looks like everything is falling into place. This is, however, as a cautionary note, where we were the last time a government shutdown happened. It looks like Congress was poised to pass legislation. Trump was going to sign it and changed his mind at the last minute. So we're very conscious that that could be the outcome. But it does seem like no one wants to relive a shutdown. Federal workers are still digging out from that 35-day shutdown. They just don't want to put people in this position again. So it does look like the leaders of both houses, Republicans and Democrats, are saying this is a good deal. It's not great, but it's the best compromise we can get. And the Republicans are really putting pressure on Trump to sign off on this. And we heard him today say over and over again, he doesn't want another shutdown. and that he's considering other ways to sort of, you know, build, finish his wall is now his new way of phrasing it, finish the wall.
Let's give a listen to President Trump talking about exactly that. This was yesterday saying, and not wild about the deal, but we can build the wall in a different way.
We're building the wall, and we're using other methods other than this. And in addition to this, we have a lot of things going. We have a lot of money in this country, and we're using some of that money, a small percentage of that money, to build the wall, which we desperately need.
People have pointed out the president using a lot of different language. You were hinting at that a moment ago, Lauren, about the status of the wall, saying we need to build the wall. We're building the wall. The wall is almost done. There he's saying we're in the midst of building it through other ways. Are we getting a little bit of a confusing message from the president about what exactly is happening with wall construction?
Yes, he has oversold the progress. Right now they're sort of debating the terms of what this funding would do. The current text, the bill that they're hoping will avert this shutdown, does include funding for fencing. This gets back to word choice. Of course, Trump's called for a wall, and he's, you know, earlier wanted a concrete wall than a steel wall. This would be fencing specifically, 55 miles of new fencing. So what is actually being built is, you know, isn't exactly as Trump is sort of portraying it, but certainly that this new deal would include some money towards, you know, fencing, which is a barrier along the border. It's new fencing, and we're seeing Republicans really claim that as a victory. You know, Nancy Pelosi said there wouldn't be $1 for this wall, and here we are, we're getting 55 miles of new fencing along the border. Obviously not exactly, as you said, what Trump has portrayed, but nonetheless it is a barrier.
Now, we're still watching for all the details on this deal, but is this something that keeps the government open for a long time, or are we back here in 2 weeks?
That's a great question. So it's going to fund the government through the fiscal year. So we'll get through September, which is, you know, a pretty big feat, because we have been seeing a lot of these 2 week, 4 week, 6 week type deals just to get through, you know, the current, or just to keep the government open while they continue this debate. So this, you know, even though it's actually just a few months and it'll fly by and we'll be in these big fraught negotiations again in September, it is a pretty significant feat, especially for a Congress that is this divided and this partisan.
We're talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian, looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're coming up. We'll talk about this proposal, this resolution from Democrats for a Green New Deal, talking about big changes in American energy policy and social policy and more. What do you think of it? Do you want to see an ambitious federal government effort to turn the tide on climate change? From what you've seen of this plan, is it in the right direction or going too far, making the wrong decisions? Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, says he wants to bring it up for a vote to get people's views on it there. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian, checking in on some of the top news out of the nation's capital. Lauren, I mentioned we'd talk about the Green New Deal idea. Yesterday, we talked to Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan about his support for that series of proposals meant to combat climate change and make some big changes to the economy. This is a non-binding resolution. It doesn't actually put policies into action. Politically, though, what is the goal here from people who are proposing this Green New Deal, Lauren?
So politically, I mean, the big, broad goal is to make the U.S. carbon neutral in 10 years. It's a stunning goal. It's breathtaking. It's almost certainly not going to happen. But they want to really kickstart the momentum around big action on climate change. I don't think there's any coincidence that, you know, it's being spearheaded by a millennial member of Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's young. She's listening to people who are saying this is something that's going to affect me in my lifetime, we need to take big action. So very broadly, I want to tackle climate change, but it also has plenty of other ideas, such as Medicare for All, the health care plan proposed by progressives, that kind of get beyond how you typically think of climate change. So they're also trying to make this a very big, broad, like holistic approach to fighting climate change.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made an announcement regarding the Green New Deal. Here's what he had to say.
I've noted with great interest the Green New Deal. And we're going to be voting on that in the Senate. We'll give everybody an opportunity to go on record and see how they feel about the Green New Deal.
Mitch McConnell and a lot of Republicans seem to see this as a winning issue for them. A lot of kind of derision and mockery, I think it's fair to say, pointed from Republicans at the Green New Deal. Can you talk about Republicans and their response?
Yes, as you said, they are pretty over the moon about this. I mean, because it is so broad and so sweeping and incorporates so many of the progressive ideas like Medicare for All and a federal jobs guarantee, this kind of idea, they think, is going to be, so easy to paint the entire party in 2020 is far too left. It has been endorsed by a number of Democratic presidential candidates, so Republicans are eager to use that against them in the presidential race. But keep in mind, the House was won. The Democrats won the House with a handful of moderate victories. These sort of purple districts. And so Republicans are looking at these districts thinking, you know, we need to put pressure on them. We need to say, you know, look at what their party's doing. Don't you, you know, you need a Republican instead. And so they're thinking that could be a kind of a winning message going into 2020. And we'll see.
And yeah, we've seen some polling out on this, and it looks like a huge generation gap in support for the Green New Deal with millennials, unlike older generations, baby boomers in particular, millennials really liking this idea, at least from the early polling we've seen. What kinds of responses have you seen in the public, even though this is pretty new?
Well, and that's it. I mean, I think that's key here. And I think there are, you know, privately, I've heard, I talked to a Republican strategist, actually, who said, you know, we need to be looking down the road here. If we're going to criticize them for this, you know, what they're mocking is sort of a silly and pie-in-the-sky idea. We need to have our own plan, because Democrats have started to come back at Republicans and say, oh, you know, for example, one Democratic senator was that I just spent the morning reviewing the Republican plan to fight climate change, and oh, wait, there isn't one. So, you know, when you look at the generation gap and you look at what young people are, you know, prioritizing in terms of issues, we've not really seen climate change be at the top of people's list, but clearly with these young people it is, and they'll be, you know, they'll be the majority of voters soon. So I think there's Democrats sort of are saying, you know what, fine, dare us to take votes on this, because we think in the long run it's a winning message. And there are some Republicans who believe that Republicans should do a better job, discussing the issue and you know, offering their own version of sort of a climate change proposal.
And meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, before it had come out, referred to the idea as the Green Dream or whatever they call it, didn't seem to be leaping into support for the Green New Deal. Are there a lot of Democrats who maybe aren't so willing to get on board here?
I mean, absolutely. Nancy Pelosi is a strategist. She could probably see this coming see the Republican criticism of it coming from a mile away, and knew that it probably wasn't the best way to secure her House majority in 2020. But that being said, they're hoping it's a conversation starter. She is she's a huge proponent of climate change. She wants to see action. And so they're hoping that this, you know, the excitement over it kind of dies down and they can focus on, you know, smaller piecemeal proposals that actually get at tackling climate change. But yeah, I Republicans are going to be asking every single purple district Democrat about this issue. And, you know, a lot of these vulnerable Democrats will have to answer for it, and they're probably not happy about that.
Talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian, looking at the latest news in national politics, from the shutdown to the Green New Deal and beyond. Let's take a quick look at the 2020 presidential field. Lauren, lots and lots of Democrats announcing, lots more expected. I won't try to break down each name right now because we don't have a year, but what are you seeing in this field? What's jumping out to you?
Well, I think the first thing is you look at this and there are more women and more candidates of color. You have a gay veteran. It's incredibly diverse. The joke is there's even a vegan. Cory Booker is a vegan. So you're looking at a really diverse field. They offer so many different choices, really, in terms of both style, substance, how to approach Trump, what types of voters they might appeal to. I mean, really, for Democrats, it's an embarrassment of riches. They have so many choices this time around. So I think that's the most striking thing. There is a tilt to the left. They are, you know, at least this initial sort of burst of candidates, we're seeing them really embrace the Green New Deal, as we were talking about, Medicare for All, these really big progressive plans that we saw Bernie Sanders champion in 2016. So, you know, there's been a few stories asking who's the candidate for the center, and, you know, maybe that's Amy Klobuchar, who just announced, and there's a few other more moderate types thinking of jumping in.
Now, you could look at it and say, oh, there's so many people, it's going to confusing chaos, it's bad for Democrats. But then looking back at the last presidential election, there were a ton of Republicans. They couldn't fit them all on one stage. So it's not necessarily a bad thing for the ultimate outcome, is it?
No, you know, there's a lot of people that thought 2016 was really reductive in the sense of, you know, you just got these, you just had two candidates and it became this test of, you know, liberal versus moderate and establishment versus non-establishment. So there's a lot of Democrats who are excited to have this debate about what the party is. And, you know, with no front runner, any one of them really has a fairly decent chance, obviously some better than others, but nonetheless, like as it is right now without Joe Biden and without Bernie Sanders in the race yet, you know, a lot of these candidates have a great opportunity. They're traveling, they're raising their profiles. So as it stands right now, it's not a bad thing for Democrats.
And finally, Lauren, a quick look at the latest on the mess in Virginia. We have the governor and attorney general there, and a top, both Democrats and a top Republican lawmaker, all being involved in one form or another of a blackface scandal from the past. Lieutenant governor for a pair of sexual assault allegations. What's the latest we're hearing from Virginia?
It's strange because they've all, to various degrees, been called on to resign, and none of them have. So there's sort of this, almost a showdown. None of them are resigning, and, you know, Governor Northam is trying to start this and going around the state, having these conversations about race as part of his healing. So he's really trying to stay in office and to hold on. But, you know, obviously, with the top three members of the government, all, you know, if one resigns, there's political consequences down the line. So if they all were to resign, you know, a Republican might take over the state, which Democrats don't want. Now there's just this very weird moment. We're kind of hanging in the balance, I guess, to see what happens next. But as it stands, none of them are stepping down.
And briefly, I saw a political correspondent, a national correspondent, tweet, remember Ralph Northam? And in this news environment, I'm sure it's going to stay big news in Virginia, it quickly gets crowded out of the national conversation.
Absolutely. I was thinking of that tweet as well, because, I mean, really, he's fallen. You know, last week it was all about Virginia, and now this week they're all still in office, and we are not talking about it.
We'll leave it there. Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Been talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian. She was with us to talk about this week's top news in national politics. Tomorrow at 3, by the way, we'll take a closer look at something President Trump called a priority in his State of the Union address, lowering prices for prescription drugs. We'll break down why drug prices are as high as they are in the U.S. compared to many other developed countries and what kind of policies might be able to bring those costs down. That's tomorrow at 3. You can get a head start. Let us know what you think about that. You can email ideas@WPR.org if you have an experience yourself with a high drug price. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. All of this year's winter seems to be concentrated in the last 4 weeks or so. If you had noticed, so much snow and cold really overtaking what had been a mild winter so far. So that's got us all looking for signs of spring coming out. Now, I was hearing people talking about how soon are the migratory birds coming back? And we're looking to schedule a show on that, I think, in early March. Talking about it now just to warm ourselves up a little. Saw people on Facebook looking for the first skunk cabbage peeking out from beneath the snow. And here's one. I see that pitchers and catchers are reporting today for spring training. So if you are excited about the first inklings of spring in the form of baseball spring training, we'd love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. And since we're talking baseball here with some quick thoughts, producer Bill Martins. Bill, it was a big year for the Brewers last year. Those pitchers are showing up, the catchers. What are you looking at?
Yeah, well, I'm really excited about this. I think, you know, 96 wins last year. It's hard to improve on that, but they really didn't lose anybody at the end of last season, and they already picked up arguably the best catcher in all of baseball. So they got a lot going for them.
And on just the sort of sentimental level, it's cold, there's a lot of snow out there. Does it warm you up a little bit to see the first action in baseball?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite times of the year. You know, spring is right around the corner.
All right. That's an optimistic way to talk about it. Thanks, Bill. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.